I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest today is author Nick Stone. Nick is one of the most prolific young adult and middle grade authors writing right now. She's best known for her books Dear Martin and Dear Justice and her Shuri series with Marvel Comics. We talk today about how she writes so much, which authors are inspiring her, and how she pushes through her own doubt. As a reminder, the Stacks Book Club pick for March is Everybody Looking by Candace Elo, and we will discuss the book in detail on Wednesday, March 31st with Nick Stone. If you're looking for ways to support this podcast, let me give you some quick ideas. The first and easiest way is free. Subscribe, rate, and review to this show wherever you get your podcasts. Take the 30 seconds and say something nice, and please just trust that it goes a long way in helping this show. And if I'm being honest, I'm not exactly sure how, but it has something to do with an algorithm, and I don't know, but it helps. You can also shop through the links in the show notes. I earn a small commission, and you get your books, so that's always great. Use the Stacks codes when you shop with our sponsors. Grab some Stacks merch at thestackspodcast.com/shop. And, of course, follow us on social media, at thestackspod on Instagram and at thestackspod_ on Twitter. And then the last way you can help support the show is arguably the most important and best way. Join the Stacks on Patreon. You contribute $5 a month and earn perks like discounts on our merch, our monthly video book club, and shout outs on the podcast. You can join by going to patreon.com/thestacks. And here are some of our latest members of the Stacks Pack: Alex Becker, Matt Taylor, Elena Langberg, Kelly McManus, Bria, Sue Carter Call, Gabriella Lott, Rosamund Hayden, Victoria Ignacio, and Sarah Lutkenhaus. Thank you all so much for your support. I could not make this show without these folks and the entire Stacks Pack. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, let's talk with Nick Stone. All right, everyone, I'm so excited today. I am joined by prolific author Nick Stone. Nick, welcome to the Stacks.
Oh, thanks. It's such a pleasure to be here finally. We tried to do this before and it didn't work because of the election.
Yeah, we were scheduled to record this conversation on the day after the 2020 election. What were we thinking?
No. I'm in Georgia. So I was like panicking. And I was like, no, we can't do this right now.
Truly one of my biggest mistakes in life. Like, I should have just known when I saw the date, and we both like were just like, it's gonna be fine. And then the night before, I sent a very, you know, casual email that was like, hey, if you don't want to record, I don't either, but if you want to, I'm available, I'm scheduled, I'm ready to go, just you tell me.
And I was like, nah, we good.
So we this good. Is the makeup call months later. So excited. We sort of always start in the same place, which is like, yes, you're an author. People are familiar with your work. Dear Martin, Jackpot, Dear Justice, the new Surrey book. But can you tell Surrey book? Surrey is my local sushi restaurant. How dare I?
Look, it's fine with me.
The Surrey book. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about Nick Stone, the human, like where you are, what else you might want us to know about you besides your bibliography?
Well, I'll tell you all the bad stuff. So I am a raging workaholic, which is why, you know, people are like, oh my God, you're so prolific. And I'm like, no, I just distract myself from real life by writing more books. It's not great. I am typically driven by scarcity mentality, also not great. Imposter syndrome is very real, also not great. But I do think clearly like some gold comes out of all of that dreck, which, you know, if you can make your neuroses into something that fuels your work, why not?
Right. That's so okay. I'm very excited to talk about this because I am fueled by pettiness and jealousy. Like that is what makes me go. I'm not a workaholic. I luckily don't have that. But like if someone else has something that I want or if someone else is doing something that I think I could do, I'm like, fuck it. I'm going to try and I'm going to do it. And I definitely have imposter syndrome because it's a weird place to create from. I think sometimes, or at least to get started from. I don't know if you find that, like if it's hard sometimes to start because the impetus to do the work is not necessarily organic to the creative part, or no?
I mean, it's interesting, right? Like the creative part, I have, it's such a separate part of my brain. Like I have been majorly depressed since like July of last year. Sure. And I've also written 3 new books. So right. it's this very strange space where like, there's all of this weird kind of not great life stuff happening, but the creative part of my brain just kicks into high gear. And like, I definitely hear you though on the idea of the impetus not being super creative. Like, it's just like, ooh, this person is, cause it's less pettiness and jealousy for me and more like wanting to achieve, like my bar setter is Jason Reynolds, right?
Of course.
It is Jason Reynolds is the only reason that I am publishing 5 books this year, because it's like, well, Jason did that, so I have to do it. You know, right. It's like anything that he does, I'm constantly chasing his shadow. And while I know I will never catch him, it is nice to have like that person that you're running behind. That actually has been helpful to the creative process. But yeah, like the workaholism, I just like, I don't know how to sit still, which interestingly enough, hasn't been detrimental.
Right. I wonder, so I've talked to Jason obviously on this podcast and we've done some lives together and just discussed creativity and I love talking with him about it. But one of the things that he has said is like his work ethic, like his working all the time, putting out books all the time, I guess not the work ethic, but the output is something that he wishes he wasn't doing and something that he now understands is like not good for him. So I'm curious, do you feel that way as well? Or do you feel like doing, because you have published, like you said, last year, 3 books, this year, another 3?
5.
Excuse me. Don't mind me. I honestly can't even keep up. Like, it's like every week on your Instagram, you're like, either. Book cover reveal. And I'm like, what is she talking about? Another book cover. But I'm just, yeah. Like, I mean, truly, I'm looking at my outline for this conversation. And besides, tell us about yourself. My next question to you is, how do you navigate needing to produce so much work and being able to put out your best work? Because that's the other thing I know about you is it's not just that you want to put stuff out into the world, but you want to be the best. Like you want to keep pushing the bar. So how do you hold up, you know, what Dear Martin was your first published book in 2017? And we're 4 years later, and I don't even want to guess because I know that I'm going to undersell the number of books because you probably published things I didn't even see.
Yeah. I just dropped number 7. And I mean, look, I will get to the point that Jason, where, you know, like he said, like he came to realize that that level of output was detrimental to him. But you have to realize that, and you don't right. realize that until you do that level of output. So like, I haven't hit the wall yet, basically. Okay. And okay. I will. I absolutely am going to hit the wall. Like, it's impossible to not hit the wall. But I feel like I'm definitely one of those people who's like, if you can do it, why not do it, right? Hmm. And it's interesting when I think about, I'm not going to not put my best work out there, but I also trust that what I'm putting out there is my best, if that right. makes sense.
Right.
So like, I'm not a person who, I don't over edit. I don't overthink. Like, I'm not a person who does like 92 drafts. I pour it out. I edit it. It goes to the editor. I edit it again. And then I take my hands off of it. And I think that it's an interesting position to be in, though, because for a long time, the idea was that if you overproduce, it winds up being a bad thing. Mm. But I keep reminding the people around me who keep saying that, like, I'm Black, that it doesn't work like that for me. It doesn't work like that for us, because there are so few things still aimed at the kids that we write for, right?
Right.
So at this point, the overproduction is actually a good thing. It's good that I have like two Shuri books coming out this year. One came out a couple weeks ago, and the next one comes out in November, because these kids are hungry for this stuff. You know, like they want to be able to pick up the next book and pick up the next book. Because when you're starting readers, when you're getting people to read who haven't read before, you can start them on a book and then they finish it. If they have nothing else to pick up, they're not going to keep reading.
Right.
So, you know, like I said, eventually I will do less. Eventually. But right now I'm like genuinely having a good time. Like I'm currently working on two pretty high profile projects, and it's just like, shit. But it's also like, this is cool. You know, like there's this weird where the imposter syndrome is like, bitch, what are you doing? Like, who do you even think you are? But then the other side is like, no, you got this. Like, just do your best. You'll be fine.
Right. So the imposter syndrome isn't like crippling for you. It doesn't hold you back necessarily. Or do you feel like it does?
It doesn't. Like with the imposter syndrome, I call it my inner hater. And like, anytime I go into a high school, I make it a point to say, make your haters your motivators.
Right.
And that's true of like my own inner hater too. Like, why would I give this bitch all the power?
Right.
Like, why would I listen to her? Like, I think, and honestly, therapy has helped me with this significantly, because I do think that the more space we give ourselves to have multiple iterations, mm-hmm. the more we're able to like enjoy life and figure out who we are and figure out how we want to move. And so having that inner hater, I'm like, I'm not going to let her win, if that right. makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I think for some people, especially maybe people who are starting out, the imposter syndrome maybe is more challenging and like gets in the way more. But I think maybe like as you start to have more success, you start to believe, even if you don't necessarily 100% believe in yourself, you're like, well, I deserve to be here because I made it here, sort of thing. At least that's what I tell myself. I'm like, I don't know that I am the greatest interviewer of all time, but like I get to talk to Nick Stone today. And so that validates some part of me, you know?
Absolutely. And I also think like a lot of my philosophies come from like a single James Baldwin quote. A lot of my like work, my approach to work is built around that. And my approach to like self-love and my approach to like my own value is built around a quote from The Fire Next Time. And it's from that introduction where he's writing this letter to his nephew. And he's basically like, yeah, like they might call you this specific word, but if that's not what you are, why would you believe them?
Right.
And there's something super powerful about the idea that I get to believe what I get to choose what I believe about myself. Right. I get to choose what I believe about my output. I get to choose what I believe about my value to the world. And so why would I choose to believe something negative if I don't have to, you know?
Right.
It's been a journey to get to that point, but it's one of those things where it's like, who can actually tell you that you're not the baddest bitch? Truly, like
right.
who can actually tell you that? And if they do tell you that, like, why would you believe them? Like, at what point do you decide that your perception of yourself is more important than other people's perception of you?
How long did it take you to arrive at this? Because this feels like some Yoda level wisdom.
I mean, look, I have never been a person who fit. right? So like from childhood on, never. So I remember being in high school and eventually just deciding that like, I didn't need to fit, right? I was a floater. I would float to different lunch tables, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was this idea of all right, I'm just going to put myself out here in this world the best way that I can. And for me, that involved like stepping into different leadership positions. And I think there's something about not fitting that's actually beneficial. Because if you don't, like when you fit, you wind up stagnating, I think. Like when you find a niche to fit into and everybody around you is doing the same thing and you have all of these people who are kind of setting the standard for the group that you're a part of, you know, like I feel like at some point who you are begins to fade away. So there's right. something to me that's super powerful about not knowing that I don't fit and knowing that like I am never going to. Right. So if I don't fit, why would I let these standards impact my view of myself? So I guess I was in my like early 20s.
Okay.
When it really settled in.
Yeah. And then you just sort of remind yourself periodically when you're feeling like when the imposter syndrome comes on, you're like, no.
Yeah.
I am that bitch.
when she starts yakking, I'd be like, who, like, sit down. Because I do think that it's a really important thing, an important exercise to pick apart where our standards for ourselves come from, right? Mm. This is something that I had to do over and over again as I made my way away from evangelical Christianity, right? Thinking about like these standards that I am doing my best to live by and these things that I am telling myself that I need to do and I need to be a part of, and like, I need to be good in this area and I need to make sure that I'm doing this, 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 and this. Why do I feel that way? Where does that standard come from? And starting to break that down was really helpful.
Yeah. I've listened to you on a bunch of podcasts in the last year or so, because I knew that this episode eventually was going to get recorded. And one of the things that you said on, when your conversation with DeRay McKesson was about sort of your journey when you went on this trip to Israel with like no plan, and you were sort of going to re-embrace your Christianity, and instead you sort of discovered that like maybe you were on the wrong track, or maybe what you had learned was not what you wanted to be. And so, and as someone who, you know, you speak to children, you speak to young people, how do you turn, so not so much the stuff that you're writing, but when you go into those spaces and you're talking as Nick, how do mm-hmm. you turn your lessons and what you know, how can you pass that on to young people without being preachy? Because I know young people love you and they like listen to you. And how are you able to connect with them without coming like looking like an old, you know?
I mean, honestly, it starts with being willing to listen to them. You know, like when I step into a high school, I step on a stage, I don't talk for more than 20 minutes before mm-hmm. I open for Q&A, because mm-hmm. there's something I think that like a lot of the time as adults, we think that we're supposed to go into these spaces and teach these kids something. I go into these spaces hoping to learn something. And that I think makes all the difference, right? Like there are lessons that I've learned over the course of life. A lot of them have to do with just like going for it. Failure's fine, like things like that. So I talk about stuff like that. I talk about empowerment. I talk about, you know, imperfection is a thing that I make up a lot of words. I use a lot of acronyms. I talk about wonder, and I talk about elasticity, and I talk about all of these things that are kind of inherent to being young. And when you point out to young people the good that's already inside of them, of course they're going to listen to you, you know, going in and not being like, hey, this is a thing that you're doing wrong and you should be doing it this way. I don't want to hear that shit. Why would a young person want to hear it?
Right.
You know, and then letting them ask the questions that they want to ask, I think is one of the most powerful things you can do with a young person, giving them the space to like cry because their brand new girlfriend just broke up with them, or they found out that their brand new girlfriend likes another girl. And like, I have mentees who will call me sobbing about things that I'm like, this is adorable. Like I don't say that to them because it's important to like meet them where they are. But I honestly think that part of the problem with adults, especially the older we get and the more we have to do, the more we're responsible for, is we forget what it was like to be young. Mm-hmm. And when you forget what it's like to be young, like, of course, you're not going to be able to connect with anybody young.
Right. What kind of questions do you get from young people that excite you? Or like, what can you think of any questions where you were like, yo, this sat with me for like a month, like I couldn't get this question out of my head or anything like that?
So honestly, the most fascinating ones are the ones that reveal the things that they care about, right? Mm. So like, I consistently get asked like how much money I make. I consistently get asked like, well, how many pairs of sneakers are in my collection? And it's interesting because those are the things that let me see what society is telling these kids is important. Mm. And so then we go into a discussion about how, you know, honestly, being okay with who you are is an act of rebellion. Like enjoying yourself in any way is an act of rebellion. Like we're constantly bombarded with messages about not being good enough. Like that's what every commercial basically is. Every right. makeup commercial is you're not pretty enough. Every weight loss commercial is you're not skinny enough. Like they're the fact that we live in a society that is consistently trying to sell us things. It's a society that feeds off of dissatisfaction. So like having these opportunities to step, taking a question and then stepping into a discussion of that and talking to them about like, what do you already have, right? Like, what do you have inside of you that you're not utilizing? And then that's when like the good deep questions will come up. There'll be the question about like, how exactly what you asked, how did you get to a point where there's stuff that doesn't phase you? It's still mm-hmm. phasing me that like, this group over here doesn't want to let me sit with them at lunch. Like, what do I do about feeling left out? What do I do about feeling like these people don't like me and it's ruining my life? Like, those are the questions that I enjoy the most, largely because I just turn it on them. And I think that answering a question with a question, especially when you're interacting with young people, is honestly one of the most valuable things you can do for them, you know, sparking critical thought in young people is genuinely my most favorite thing to do because they're so full of ideas and they're so full of magic and they have this innovative brain that, you know, I'm like, okay, so what do we replace the standard policing system with, right? Like I'll ask that question and like five hands will shoot up and they have all of these ideas, right? So just giving them the space to think for themselves is such a powerful thing. I did not answer your question at all, but
it's okay. You answer my question with a question because I have a question for you now. So look, that is how Nick, the person, kind of approaches these young people when you're doing Q&As or when you're, you know, face to face with young folks, or I guess in these days, Zoom or whatever you're doing. How are you approaching connecting with young folks in your writing? Because some kids maybe will read your work before you go to their school. And I'm sure some children like me will wait to meet you and see how I feel before I decide if I'm going to pick up your book, you know? So I'm curious how you sort of approach them when you're going at it through this fiction lens versus, hi, I'm in the room. You can feel my energy. You can see my vibe. Like, how do you approach it that way?
Honestly, it's the same. I talk to them, you know, like I have yet to write a book for, you know, anybody between 8 and 18 without talking to somebody in the age range of the protagonist. Like with Dear Martin, the guy on the cover, actually, I remember having a number of in-depth conversations with him about, you know, like, what do you do when you're stopped by police? Are you afraid of the police stopping you? Are you afraid of being profiled? And I remember him very vividly saying like, nah, I just know what's going to happen. And even things like that, getting insight into how they think and how they feel. For Dear Justice, I traveled the country for months visiting juvenile detention centers because I want the stuff on the page to be authentic, right? So I'm talking to these kids in these facilities and I'm talking to, you know, people who go into the facilities to help them write poetry. And I'm getting to have these conversations with kids that society has basically decided they're done with. And it's in that space, in giving them my attention, I'm able to connect with them, which makes it easier for me to connect with the character and to present the characters as these fully formed human beings who are complex, who have conflicting ideas in their heads, who one minute believe one thing and the next they've changed their mind and they believe something different, who want one thing one minute and then the next minute they want something different. giving the respect to the age range that you are writing for, I think is really the key to writing well in the middle grade and young adult space. And it's wild because if I had like a dollar for every person that I've interacted with that writes young adult novels and doesn't like teenagers, I'm like, the fuck? Like, I don't, how is this a thing that you do? I just like, it's a thing that just boggles my mind. Like you're writing, and these are people who are writing for themselves. They're not actually writing for young people. They're writing for themselves and hoping that young people are going to be into what they're into now as adults. And it typically doesn't work.
Okay. So you just said, you know, you're writing for young people. Can you be more specific? Who are you writing for aside from people between the ages of 8 and 18? Like, or within that group, is there other specific children or young folks that you're thinking of? Does that change with every book? Like, what does that look like?
It definitely changes with every book. So, you know, Dear Martin, interestingly enough, Dear Martin, I just wrote for my sons. My sons are 4 and 8, but Dear Martin was sparked by the death of Jordan Davis in Jacksonville in 2012. And my older son at that point was 5 months old. And I just, it shook me, right? Like this idea that this black boy who came out of my body, like having babies is a whole ordeal. Like I grew this person and then I shoved him out of a very small opening without drugs.
Ma'am.
I was like, nah, I got this. And I just screamed my head off
for
the whole time. But once it's out, you're like, okay, that was a lot of work. I want you to stay alive, right?
For sure. Like
you want your babies to stay alive. So hearing about this kid in Florida who lost his life because a white man didn't like the music he was listening to, like I was like, what? So it's with that particular book, I wanted to create something that I could hand to my son when he was older. Hmm. And then a lot of people started to read it. And I was just like, oh, okay. So this is what is happening now. With Odd One Out, Odd One Out is the one book that I did write for my own. It's like a love letter to my own closeted teenage self. And then from there, you know, Jackpot is for the poor kids who live in rich neighborhoods. Dear Justice I dedicated it to a couple of boys that I mentored when they were in high school. They've both graduated now, but they were the impetus for Dear Justice because they asked me to write that book. So I wrote that book for them. And of course, for all of the boys that I was talking to in these detention centers. So it really does. It changes with each book. And that actually is what makes it fun for me, you know, knowing that I have an opportunity to just like, I'm going to write this one for you, and I'm going to write that one for you, and I'm going to write this one for you. And I know that none of you have actually had anybody write anything for you before. I'm actually very excited about, I have a book coming out in the fall called Fast Pitch, and it's a Black girl softball book because I was a Black girl softball player. And at the time I was the only Black girl softball player on my team, but knowing that there are other Black girl softball players out there. So like Fast Pitch is a book for the Black girl softball players, right? Like anybody else can read it. Cool. I hope you enjoy it. But like, this is for my Black girl softball players.
So what happens when for you as the creator, because I'm obsessed with audience. I'm obsessed. I went to theater school. I was obsessed with audience then. I was a dancer. Like I've always, even with this podcast, I'm obsessed with who's listening and what they think about the work. Not that I make the work, you know, for anyone else, but, you know, I'm aware that no matter who is in my mind consuming my work, that there are people who are outside of my intended audience. And so I am so curious how you respond to the people that you are not intending to read your book. Not that they can't read it, but not the people that you have in mind, not the people, you know, and I'm sure you get feedback both very positive and very negative from people who are not your intended audience. So how do you deal with that?
You know, interestingly enough, I haven't gotten a ton of negative feedback from people who are not a part of the intended audience. Like I can count on one hand the number of negative emails I've gotten about books that I've written.
But and, like, what about like, your books being banned? I mean, I consider that to be like negative feedback for people you don't write. Like not necessarily a specific email
that's
like, hey, Nick, fuck you. But like the general, your book's not allowed in our county, period. Like have a nice life.
You know what? I will say that the pressure and the backlash that superintendent faced, she retired.
Good.
At the end of last year. And I'm like, yes, holler.
Yeah,
out of there. I mean, look, I honestly, I don't really care, Tracy. Okay. Like, it's one of those things where if you are a part of my intended audience, your opinion is the one that I care about. If you are not a part of my intended audience and you read it and love it, fantastic. You read it and you learn something from it, wonderful. You read it and it expands your worldview, love it. You read it and you hate it, I don't care. I don't care at all. But I think that, like, I'm also a firm believer that, you know, really to quote John Green, and I don't even know if he's the originator of the quote, but like, he's the person who kind of instilled this into me, books belong to their readers, right? Mm-hmm. Once I'm done writing a book, it's not mine anymore. Once it like goes out into the world, it belongs to whoever picks it up from the library, whoever buys it at the store. Like, I've done my part. So if you read it and you hate it and you want to burn it, cool. Ain't got nothing to do with me. That's your $18 that's gone, not mine. Right. I still got my royalty chunk from that thing that you bought. Right. So there's a certain level of detachment that I feel from the work once I finish it, because mm-hmm. at that point it's like, okay, I did what I was supposed to do. I can move on now.
Right. And what about adults? What do you think about adults?
I don't like us very much, if you want the truth.
Sure.
I think that we could do a better job of being authentic. Look, like I'm house shopping right now, right? Like, I'm 35 and I'm about to purchase my first home.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This shit is terrifying.
So scary.
And like, it is. And the idea of like I see people like, yeah, I got this. I'm like, you don't. You're secretly freaking out inside. And that is totally okay. I think we put this pressure on ourselves to be adults. And I put that in quote, be adults. But like, really, adults are just toddlers who can legally drink alcohol and have to pay bills.
Right.
Truly is how I think about it. And I think that the more we give ourselves the space to not be so crotchety, man, what a better world it would be.
So
I also think that when I interact with adults in spaces where I'm also talking to children, so like administrators in high schools and teachers, I find that a lot of adults are trying to stifle kids and keep them from doing things that they were doing when they were young, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from shame. And I think that like we could all stand to dig in a little bit and consider why we don't want our children doing literally the same shit that we were doing when we were young, right? Like, I did some crazy shit when I was young. Thank God it didn't kill me.
Right.
But I'm also not going to tell my kids, like, don't do that. It's really, really bad, because that would make me a hypocrite and I don't like hypocrisy. So like, I will tell you my experience with this thing that you think that you should do. And I'm going to hope you're going to make a good decision based on my experience. But I do think that there's something to be said for adults relating to young people as actual human beings and not as these little robots that we get to program. Like, they are stories to be read, not books to be written.
Hmm. That's so good. I literally just looked at the time and I'm like, oh my God, we're already like really cruising and I have a million questions to ask you and I haven't gotten to any of them. So I'm going to try to finish this quickly because I just have so much I want to talk to you about. Dear Martin, Dear Justice, both of those books have a lot to do with, you know, police violence, profiling, obviously racism against Black children, specifically Black boys and young, I guess not, they're boys, they're not men.
Yes.
I'm curious, I'm sure you could go on for hours and hours about police violence and racism and all this stuff, but I want to know specifically the ways that your understanding of racism and police violence and all of those things, incarceration, has changed since this past summer. Since you've seen the response of white people to this quote unquote racial reckoning, how your understanding of the work that you've created in relationship to this newer moment of Black lives. And I guess what I'm really asking you is how white people's response to the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others has influenced or changed the way that you understand race and racism.
It hasn't at all. Like, congratulations, white people. I'm glad you're waking up, but I haven't been sleeping for years, right?
Sure.
So I think, and it's interesting, with the work that I do in that space, the Dear Martins, the Dear Justices, the Clean Getaways, right? Like Clean Getaway is like Dear Martin light. So it's right. for like third through fifth graders still dealing with racism, still dealing with civil rights history. It's Dear Martin light. Like I said, those are the books that I'm those are the books that I feel responsible for writing. Like this is the contribution that I have that I can make to other people's understanding of race and racism, especially young people's understanding of race and racism, because I do feel like as a person who does study this stuff and who is deeply interested in how things got to be the way that they are, anything that I learn, I think it's important for me to like put it back out in the world in some way. Mm-hmm. There will be someone, even if there's only one person who stumbles upon it and learns something or thinks a different way because of it, great. But when it comes to like, I'm doing that work though, more for like the kids that are like my kids, for the Black kids. As much as I think it's great when white kids are able to connect and they start seeing things in a different way, honestly, it's just kind of like a fringe benefit because mm-hmm. really what I care most about is Black people realizing that there is nothing wrong with us. Right. You know, as a matter of fact, there is more right with us than there is with like a lot of the way, like it has to do with like our perception of ourselves, I think, is a lot of the problem, and helping people to recognize that perception of ourselves doesn't actually come from us. Like that's the job that I'm trying to do.
Right.
So when white people come to the work, when white people decide that they're waking up, I'm like, cool. Are you going to stay awake?
Right.
Because the truth is they don't have to, right? Like I've been watching, these companies that say they're making all these changes, I just watch.
Right.
And I'm like, let's see if you really go, including some of the companies I'm involved with. I'm like, right. What are you doing? Have you changed any leadership positions? Have you added any people of color to your marketing department?
Right.
Have you added any, are there Black interns now? Like, do you have, what are you actually doing? Like you talked a good game
right.
last year,
right?
But cool. And it's one of those things where I do think that we're getting to a point now where we don't really need y'all to wake up. We just gonna do it ourselves.
Right.
I think about all of the successful Black businesses. I think about all of the people who have decided that like, wait a minute, no, I'm going to acquire resources and I am going to build something for my people that will, where we can thrive. And I personally think it's great,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I do too. The reason I asked that question is also just because I know that with the work that you do, like we talked about traveling into schools and seeing a lot of different kids from a lot of different places. Like I know you don't just talk to kids in Atlanta. I know you don't just talk to kids in Brooklyn. I know that you're talking to kids in rural North Dakota. I know that you're talking to kids in Oklahoma. I know the work that young adult authors and middle grade authors are doing. And so the reason that I was curious about how your perception has changed is because as someone like you who studies race and racism and the structures that are in place, I did have my thinking around race changed because I realized how much worse off we were than I thought. I kind of thought more white people like knew about Black Lives Matter. And like, not that I knew that there was still racism, but I was sort of shocked that like people that were my friends that I was like, wait, what's the question? Like, so yeah. I was wondering if you kind of had a moment at all like that where you were like, I knew y'all were bad at this, but I kind of thought you guys were like, I thought maybe some of you were doing the work a little bit in what, like, I really had a moment of like, oh shit. And that includes my white mom. Like, I had to have conversations with her where I was like, you know, that's like, you can't say that, mom. And she was like, no, I didn't know that. And I was like, I love you. And I know that you like love Black people, but like, that's a no, that's a big no. Like, we're going to have to fight now, you know? And so I just wonder, because I know that you interact with so many different kinds of people that most Americans are not interacting with, that many different kinds of people from different socioeconomic, racial, sexual orientation, ability. I know that you're interacting in different spaces. So that's where the question came from. I'm not surprised that not a lot has changed, but I just was curious based on your,
I think honestly, because of all of that interaction, my expectations are
so low.
when I have white passing cousins, like not white presenting, but like they basically live as white people. And I remember getting getting a message from one of my cousins, and it shook her up. Like what was going on last year shook her up, and I was glad for it, you know? But I also was a surprise.
Right.
At this point, it takes a lot to surprise me because of some of the stuff that I've seen. I will never forget, Tracy. I was in Hastings, Minnesota at this high school. It was like 800 students in the auditorium. Maybe 1% were kids of color. It was like eight brown kids in the room.
Great.
And I remember going into a classroom, not a lick of any color other than white in this classroom, and having a young lady, she was probably in ninth or 10th grade. She raised her hand and I was like, "What's up, babe?" She's like, "If I want to go out into the middle of the street and shout the N-word, I just feel like I should be able to do that because I have free speech." And I was like, "Yeah, cool, go for it. Just remember and understand that ain't nobody going to like you." Like,
right.
I think that there's this disconnect between this idea of their rights, right? Like, these are my rights. Mm-hmm. I can tote this gun. I can say whatever the fuck I want to say. Yeah, you can, but there are social consequences.
Right.
And we're seeing that happen more and more online, where you have people just outraged over quote unquote cancel culture. And I'm like, look, if you say messed up things, the public can absolutely decide they don't want to rock with you no more.
Right.
That has nothing to do. Nobody's restricting your speech.
Right.
Nobody's telling you that you can't have the viewpoint that you have. You just got to recognize that, like, people not vibing with that anymore. Right.
Right.
And the people that I meet, I met a high schooler, a high school senior at a really bougie private school here in Atlanta. And like, I'm talking to them about Dear Martin, and this girl raises her hand and she's like, "But what about the illegitimacy rate?" I was like, "The what?" She was like, "You know, the illegitimacy rate in the Black community." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" She's like, "The number of Black kids who grow up without fathers." And I looked at her and I said, "Honey, what makes a person, a human being, illegitimate?" And she zipped it, because it's like they have these words, these ideas that they toss around. Like and because I encounter that so much, girl, bye.
Right. Okay. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We have this segment called Ask the Stacks. Someone has written in, they want a book recommendation. So I'm going to read to you what they're looking for, and then you're going to come up with at least one recommendation. I will give them three because I had a little time to prep, and you've had a none. So this comes from Alexandra, and they say, do you have any recommendations for books that explore biracial identity, preferably non-white biracial identity, or elements of othering between cultures and identities? I love a lot of YA books. For this, like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, Love Boat Taipei, and The Astonishing Color of After, but I am looking to read more in adult fiction and I don't know much. Okay.
Yes.
I'll go first if you want to think for a second and then.
No, I'm good. Oh, because I think you're going to say some of the ones I got to give them before you
do. You go first.
The Vanishing Half.
Okay.
Obviously, I think is one that everyone should read. And then The Girl Who Fell from the Sky.
I don't know that.
I cannot remember here. Let me look up who the author is. Heidi Duro is okay. The name of the author. Those are the two that I recommend for, you know, kind of exploring biracial identity for adults in the adult realm.
That's so good. Neither of those were on my list. So I feel really good that you came up with things I don't have. So my first one is Caucasia by Danzy Senna. That is black and white racial identity, but biracial identity, but it's really good. So just read it. Then one that just came out as of the recording of this episode is called What's Mine and Yours by Naima Coaster. And it's about it's actually not one person with biracial identity, but it's about two different families. One is white and Colombian, and then one is black. So it's sort of about the relationship between these families and these people. And then the last one is also about the cultural dynamics, and it's called Your House Will Pay by Steph Cha. And it's sort of a fictionalization of the Latasha Harlings case in LA, in the LA riots, but it's all fictionalized and it's about a Korean family and a black family. So those would be my recommendations. And Alexandra, if you read any of our five books, you must tell us how we did and if you loved them.
Yes.
Okay, now we get to talk about Nick's favorite and maybe not so favorite books. And we'll start where we always start. Two books you love, one book you hate.
Two books I love. Let's see. So I am a Britt Bennett stan.
Okay.
So I just recommended The Vanishing Half, but honestly, my favorite book that she's released is the other one, is The Mothers.
So good.
Good Lord, that damn book.
Yeah.
And then Nafisa Thompson Spires, Her Heads of the Colored People.
So good.
Huh. Can I do one more?
Sure.
We're like, go ahead. These are my holy trinity. And the third is Friday Black by Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. So two of those are adult short story collections, and The Mothers is a novel. But like, they are just so rich and textured, and the prose is immaculate. And I just like, oh, to be able to write like that is how I feel when I read those books.
Oh my gosh,
a book that I hate. I hate Lord of the Flies.
Okay.
With a deep and burning passion. When I was younger, I used to call that book, These Little White Boys Need Their Asses Whooped.
Not Piggy,
that was my,
no.
Yeah, look.
Can you write like a fanfic non-fanfic of Lord of the Flies, I would love like a modern retelling that was better. Because I feel like there's so much potential there, right?
Yeah, look, there is one. Libba Bray did one called Beauty Queens.
Okay.
And it is fantastic.
Okay,
like, it's just like Lord of the Flies retelling about a group of beauty queens who get stranded on an island. And it's just like, it's fantastic. Fantastic. Right.
Okay. Okay. What's the last really great book you've read?
Ooh, let's see. The last really great book I read doesn't come out until September.
Well, can you tell us what it is? We can get on team pre-order.
The only problem is like it hasn't announced. And so let me tell the last great book I read that has announced. George Matthew Johnson's next memoir, which is called, hold on. Yes, We Are Not Broken.
Okay.
Yes and Amen. That book is fantastic. So like their first book was All Boys Aren't Blue.
Right.
And it was great. And We Are Not Broken is just this beautiful exploration of family dynamics and interrelationship between boys and this grandmother figure. And it is just, yeah, you'll cry a lot. Just be ready for that.
Okay. And what are you reading right now?
Right now, I am rereading How to Be an Anti-Racist by Dr. Ibram Kendi. And I am also reading a book called Ace of Spades. It comes out in June. It's by an author named Farida. I'm going to butcher her last name, but and my Nigerian spouse is going to be so upset with me for butchering this name because I should be able to pronounce it. But it's Farida Abike Iyimide, I think.
Good.
But yes, it's good.
Okay. And do you often read multiple books at once, or are you more of a one book pony?
No, I definitely read multiple books at once, which is, I don't actually recommend that, but like it, press for time.
Life happens. What about, how much are you reading? Cause you're writing all the time, it sounds like. So you can read things and be writing and those, that doesn't affect you or get in your way.
Yeah, as long as I'm reading something different from what I'm writing, it's fine. And I do a lot of audiobooking. I'm a huge fan of a solid audiobook.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite audiobooks or recently been some of your faves?
Honestly, the book we're going to talk about today is I love that audiobook. It's short. It's like 3 hours long.
Yes.
And that's Everybody Looking.
Yeah.
Yes. By Candace Elo. Another audiobook, Neil Schusterman. Okay. So I am a massive Neil Schusterman fan. So Neil Schusterman is, for those who are unfamiliar, he is a pretty much exclusively young adult writer. Like I can't think of a whole lot that he's written that's not young adult, but he does this thing where he will cloak social issues in sci-fi fantasy stories and speculative fiction. And he has a series called The Ark of a Scythe. So the three books are Scythe. Oh boy. The second one is called Thunderhead. And the third one is called The Toll. And those audiobooks are so good.
Okay.
They're so good.
Okay. And do you reread a lot?
No, I don't. If I reread it, it means that like it was bomb.
Okay.
So books that I have reread, Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds. I cannot tell you how many times I've read that book. There's a few. There are a few that I have reread and would read again and again and again and again. Some of Jacqueline Woodson's books. Another Brooklyn. That's a rereader.
So good.
That's a rereader.
Oh my gosh.
Rereader.
That is such a good book. Oh.
Yes. And Jessamyn Ward, she's also like, you reread those. You definitely gonna reread Jessamyn.
What can you say about Jessamyn Ward? Not a lot.
I met her and I like almost peed on myself.
Did you? She followed me on Instagram and I peed myself. Like, so I can only imagine.
Oh, yeah. And I like walk up to her and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm such a stan. And she's like, oh, hey, Nick. And I was like, what is happening? Like, she's like, yeah, I follow you on Twitter. And I was like, hi.
It's true. I mean, it's truly like paralyzing when people that you admire or think the world of acknowledge you in any way. It's like, oh, you liked my photo. Thank you. Thank you for seeing me.
I feel so good about myself.
Oh my gosh. Okay. What makes you pick up a book?
I don't know. Sometimes it's a title.
Okay.
A title can make me interested in a book. A cover. I am definitely a, ooh, I like that cover. Let me see what this is about.
Same.
But I will also say I'm not a person who reads flap copy. I will read the first five pages. Okay. And if you grab me by page five, I'll read the book. But yeah, like the minute you lose me, I'm putting it down. Like I'm not a person who's going to push my way through anything.
Okay.
So you either got me by page five or I'm probably not going to finish. Okay. No shade. Just not my cup of tea, you know?
Right, right. Do you set any reading goals or goals around your reading?
I used to, but now I have too much other stuff to do. Mm-hmm. And so I would just be like devastated about not meeting the goal. Mm. So, you know, back in like 2015, 2016, I was reading like 100 books a year, but now there is no way.
Right.
In any, yeah, nah.
But you weren't writing 5 books a year when you were reading 100. You have like
valid.
We need you to read less and write more so we have things to read. No offense, but
see?
It's just
right. And now I'm like, now I want to flip it. I'm like, let me write less and read more so that I have things to read.
That's true. You should just do whatever feels nice for you. You've already given so much, you know, like I'm all for taking the pressure off authors. Like you guys do so much. You don't need any more pressure from us. How do you organize your books or do you?
By author, typically. So my favorite shelf, I have two bookcases in my office that have my favorites on them. And I'm looking at them right now so I can tell you who they are. So Jason Reynolds takes up like half of the top shelf of the first bookcase because he has published so much amazing work.
And what's your favorite Jason Reynolds book?
The Boy in the Black Suit. Okay. It's his second novel, and it's the one that like the fewest people know about.
But that's the one so he said was his favorite.
Oh my God, I love that book so much. It's yeah, the best.
I just
and he knows
it.
That's my favorite.
I just bought it. So I never good. Read it. So
it's
I have
so,
to
it's so like sweet, and you get this beautiful love story, and you're also seeing this black boy grapple with the concept of death. Like it's just it's Jason, but it's like Jason before Jason was Jason.
Right.
I even have Jason books that were published like years ago. Like I have like 3 books that Jason published that nobody even knows about.
Wow.
And they cost me a lot of money, which lets you know how much I admire that man. So like, yeah, there's Jason's up there. Angie Thomas is up there. Becky Albertalli, Tiffany D. Jackson, Ashley Woodfolk, Danielle Clayton, Elizabeth Acevedo, and Lamar Giles. And Brendan Kiley. Those are the people on my like favorite shelf.
Favorites. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't
even remember what your question was.
How you organize your books.
Oh yes, by author.
By author. okay. And then what about the last really good book that someone recommended you to read? Recommended to you.
Oh, that's a really good question. Oh, there's a book called Fiebre Tropical.
Yes.
Oh my Lord. That book is fantastic. And Daniel Handler, or Lemony Snicket, is the person who recommended that book to me. And it is this beautiful like story about like discovering one's queer. The character like is discovering their queer identity. And it's like written in Spanglish. And it is just riveting. Like I love reading books that play with language because there's so much. Languages are just beautiful. And so right. I really, really enjoyed that book.
What's the last book that you purchased?
Probably one of my own, because I had a book come out a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
So I think Shuri the Vanish is probably the last book I purchased. I'm like sitting here looking through what's here. Yeah, I think... No, yes, that's the last book I purchased, but I purchased one before that called One of the Good Ones. Mm-hmm. It's by, it's a pair of sisters.
Women Who Wrote.
Mike and Maritza.
Dear Haiti. The Women Who Wrote
yes,
Dear Haiti.
Okay. Dear Haiti, Love Elaine. Yeah, so that's the last book I purchased before purchasing. I make it a point to go purchase my own books on the day that they come out just to like remind myself that all of this is real.
Yeah, that's so special.
It is.
Is it crazy when you see your book in the store?
Girl, so I am a Target hit. Like Target is my jam.
Okay.
And my family, we went to Maui for Thanksgiving last year because the world was shit. And I was like, let's just go on vacation somewhere where we have to test to get in. So we go to Maui and we go to Target in Maui and they had 4 of my books on the shelf. And I like melted on the floor. Yeah.
That's yeah. So great.
I bought my book from Walmart for the first time toward the end of last year. It's very surreal.
Yeah.
It's very surreal.
What a cool thing. Okay. What's the last book that made you laugh?
Probably Wings of Ebony by J.L.
Okay.
There's some little humorous tidbits in there.
Okay. Last book that made you cry.
You know, I don't typically cry when reading. So it takes a lot to get me to cry. But the one that I recommended from George.
Yeah.
Matthew Johnson. Yeah. That one got me. That one got me pretty good.
Okay. The last book that made you angry.
Oh, there's a book called When You Look Like Us.
Okay.
The author's name is Pam Harris. And but I will tell you, an author that consistently makes me angry with their books is Tiffany D. Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be wanting to fight her. I'll be wanting to fight Tracy.
I read my first of her books last year. I read Monday's Not Coming. And I was like,
girl,
I don't know about this.
Just appalling. And she does it with every. So she has a book coming out in the fall that hasn't announced yet.
Okay.
And, I'm just angry. Like I angry text her when I'm reading her books because I'm just like, bitch, like, how dare you?
How dare you?
But that's
exactly
so
right.
So
that's exactly. It's like a, how dare she write this book? That's also frustrating, at least for me, when I read Monday's Not Coming, is like, I knew exactly where we were going. Like, it wasn't like she tricked me and I was like, oh, you tricked me. It was like, we're doing exactly what you said that we're going to do. And still, yes. I am mad at you because I felt so you were good. Yeah, it's like, I thought you were lying when you said we were doing this. Like, why are we still here? She's great. Okay. What about a book, the last book where you felt like you learned a lot?
The Black Friend by Frederick T. Joseph.
Okay.
And it's interesting because it's not necessarily like it's learning different perspectives, right? So it's stuff that I'm constantly talking about, but hearing it from these different angles was pretty dope.
Yeah. What about a book that you are proud to have read?
Ooh. Stamped from the Beginning. That book is a dude, like the not the Jason Reynolds version, the Dr. Kendi
version.
The big boy. Ooh, and look, I will admit, I audiobooked it, but like
I couldn't audio that because I struggle with reading comprehension when I'm listening and I lose focus. So I have, if something's really dense, I have to read it with my eyes because I have to have my full attention.
Yeah,
I can like read memoir audio because I feel like I kind of know where we're going. But if it's something like really dense like that, I had to go all in, like locked in the bathroom, Wi-Fi off when I was reading Stamped.
With your pencil, you have to like underline things. You know, another book for me in this category is Beloved by Toni Morrison. Like Toni Morrison's book. But that's a really hard book. Like it is a hard book.
We did it on this show with Damaris Hill and if you go back and listen to the episode, I come into the episode and I'm like, I have no fucking clue. And she breaks it down.
Man.
It's still one of my most favorite episodes because I literally enter the conversation with like, I don't know, please help me. And she breaks, she just starts and she just goes. And now I'm like, I need to reread it because I can understand it's like I think you have to read that book like 100 times to get it.
Yeah. It's so complex. I'm thankful. I read a lot of Toni Morrison's books while I was an undergrad at Spelman, and like being surrounded by other Black women makes it a little easier to understand.
Yeah.
But like, look, Toni be like, "Oh, this paragraph, we're gonna make it 3 pages long."
Yeah, good luck. Have fun. Okay, you're the perfect person to ask this question of, which is, if you were a teacher in high school, what is the book that you would assign your students?
There's a book called The 57 Bus. The author's name is Sasha Slater.
Yes.
Man.
That takes place.
Exactly. It does. And it's nonfiction. And if I had to, like, if I was a teacher and I had to assign one book, it would be that book.
Yeah.
If I had more than one, I would assign The Bells by Donyell Clayton.
Okay.
That's, it's a book that deals with like beauty culture and norms and like, it deals with it in a very cool way. And I would also assign, Sunny from Jason Reynolds' Track series.
Okay.
Because it's written in this kind of stream of conscious stream of consciousness, semi-epistolary type thing. And just the way that it's written makes it a really, I think it would be a really cool book to teach.
Okay.
On like the art of writing.
Okay. And then if you could have one person write the book of your life, that's not you, can't be you, who would you want?
I would want Tiffany Jackson to do it.
Okay.
She
to piss
would,
us
like,
off.
Make it spicy. Yeah. She would like, she'd be like, and then at the end we find out Nick was a murderer.
Yeah.
Like there would be some really cool twist that she would plop in there.
If you turn out to be like a serial killer or something, people are going to go back to this podcast and be like, she just casually mentioned it. She was leaving clues for us all along.
That, like, she totally has murderous tendencies. I really don't. I'm a lover, not a killer.
Good. Please. Just, I'm glad we're doing this remotely just in case. Okay. Last question for you before we, you know, go to our book club conversation. I steal this one from the book, from the New York Times by the book. You're only the second person on the history of the podcast to answer it this way. So if you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Okay.
That book, I think it takes Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, kind of gives it a bit of an update, and is just as relevant today as it was. Honestly, it's probably more relevant today than it was when it came out years ago. I think every sitting leader in the world should be required to read that book. It's short. You got no excuses for not getting through it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be learned, a lot to be gleaned.
Oh, that's such a good book. All right, everyone. This is Nick Stone. Nick will be back with us at the end of the month to discuss Everybody Looking by Candace Elo. And there will be spoilers on a conversation, so please read it. It's super short. You can audiobook it. It's a book. It's a young adult book in verse. So I promise you, if you get the physical copy, it looks big. It's not nearly as long as you think. And Nick has 7 books in the world. And you should get all of her books. And if you are like, I already have all of them, don't worry. Apparently she has 5 more coming out this year. So just hold tight. Just hang on. Put the money in savings. Let it accrue some interest or whatever. Financially plan. And then go get the rest of the books. We didn't even talk. Well, I'll save it for next week. But we didn't even talk about the Blackout book, which I feel like we have to talk about.
We're going to have to talk about that. Absolutely.
So that's a teaser. Come back the last week of the month to discuss Blackout and Everybody Looking. Nick, thank you so much for being here.
Look, thanks for having me and letting me just blab for an hour.
Amazing. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you so much to Nick Stone for being our guest. Also a special thank you to Pete Forrester and Kathleen Dunn for making this episode possible. Nick will be back on March 31st to discuss Everybody Looking by Candace Elo for the Stacks Book Club. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at TheStacksPod on Instagram and at TheStacksPod_ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer, and our graphic designer is Robin McCrae. Our theme music is from Tegirigis, and The Stacks was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.